My next guest is Jeffrey Deskovic. He's an American man from upstate New York known for having been wrongly convicted in 1990 at the age of 17 for raping, beating, and strangling a young girl. He made a false confession, which he withdrew, and his DNA was excluded from that left at the scene. He was nonetheless convicted based on police testimony that he confessed. He served 16 years, and although he continued to maintain his innocence and appeal his conviction. You do not want to miss this interview with Jeffrey Deskovic, next on the Criminal Justice Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Patrick here, wherever you were at, whatever you were doing, thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with us. That's why we continue to grow. That's why we're top rank, because of you, the listener and supporter. If you're not subscribed to the show, please do so. Continue to share it with your family and friends. And lastly, when you have a moment, please give us that five-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. I love my Lion's Mane coffee from Four Sigmatic, and I bet you will too. It is mushroom coffee. Yes, I said mushrooms, the good mushrooms, not the bad mushrooms. It tastes great, gives me that energy, clarity, and zip that I need to get me through my day. Head over to cjevolution.com, see the link to Four Sigmatic. You are going to love their products, and best of all, 15% off of your purchases using the promo code CJEVO. Enjoy. Ah, so excited to be partnered with The Badge Life. If you've never heard of this company, my friend Tony Malik created this company for you, the first responder and criminal justice professional. They got great apparel, gym gear, tank tops, hoodies, they have it all. You're going to love their products. Now, if you head over to cjevolution.com, you're going to see the link to The Badge Life. Click on that link and get prepared to be wowed by all their amazing products, again, for you, the first responder. So excited to be partnered with Detecticum. This amazing and innovative company is helping keep our brave men and women who protect us every day safer by offering app-based technology fits in the palm of their hand, detecting illicit drugs, explosives, now COVID-19. You got to check out this company, folks. You need their product for your organization. Head over to cjevolution.com, see the link to Detecticum, and see how they can help keep your troops safer. On to this amazing show with Jeffrey Deskovic. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have my next guest on the show, Jeff Deskovic. He was wrongly convicted in 1990 by the criminal justice system, and he's going to tell us about his story along with other information about criminal justice reform. And his story is just amazing. Jeff, are you there, brother?
I absolutely am here. Thanks for having me on, Patrick.
Well, thank you for having or coming on the show, Jeff. Gia Wirtz was on my show recently or a couple weeks ago, and I'm so glad that she kind of passed along this show to you and you agreed to come on, sir. And thank you for being here. And like I said in the intro, Jeff, I mean, your life has been, you know, I mean, it was turned upside down at a very young age in your life. Can you talk about this conviction, this wrongful conviction that occurred in 1990 when you were 17, right, Jeff?
Absolutely right. Yes, definitely. So the year was 1990, and I was a sophomore in college. The setting is Peekskill, which is in Westchester County, New York. So it's the suburbs, and it's an ethnically diverse city. Population of approximately 25,000 people. It was middle class. For context, there really hadn't been a murder there in maybe 20 years. Mm-hmm. So when this murder happened, it created an atmosphere of fear, rumor, and with, you know, the safety of their children and their own safety. I got on the police radar because growing up, in high school, I kind of lived a double life, right, mm-hmm. in a way. So I grew up in an apartment complex, and there was a lot of kids that lived in that complex and in the surrounding areas. And I was one of the two main kids that kind of whatever I suggested would be what we would do. So we might play stickball or basketball if we're going to ride bike or go play Monopoly or go do video games. And, you know, we even made up different games. But that was after school, you know. Yeah. In school, you know, very early on, I had skipped a grade, I think I skipped first grade, and that really showed up in the high school because, you know, kids were into drinking beer and parties and chasing girls and organized sports, and I was not. I was just playing video games and playing, you know, pickup games with my friends. Apartment complex. So as a result of that, in school, I was quiet to myself. I didn't fit in. I felt uncomfortable and tight, you know? So when the police interviewed a lot of students from the high school, some of them told the police, well, they might want to talk to me because I didn't fit in. So that got me on their radar. I would say a secondary factor was that I was kind of a sentimental teenager. This was really my first brush with death. And I had an emotional reaction to that. I mean, and so I think the police interpreted my being emotional as some sort of outward manifestation, like I was sorry for what I had done, that it was unusual that I would have this emotional reaction to the death of somebody who was she was in two of my classes as a freshman, just one as a sophomore. I knew her name, she knew mine, that was it. We weren't even on a high-bye basis. So maybe a third thing was they got a psychological profile from the NYPD, which purported to have the psychological characteristics of the actual perpetrator. And I had the misfortune of matching that. So that's how I got on the police radar.
But her name was Angela Correa?
Angela Correa. Mm-hmm. Angela
so, Correa. I mean, it just kind of, it's interesting to me that, you know, I what kid isn't awkward at that age? You know, I mean, and it's interesting. I mean, she was nice to you, right? I mean, and just because you were kind of different and you were interested in different things, it's amazing to me that the police kind of just zeroed in on you right away and without really any kind of, you know, I mean, I was a cop for many years and usually there's a little bit more, you know, besides, oh, well, you know, he's kind of awkward. And I'm not saying you're awkward, brother. I'm just saying that he was into his own thing. I mean, it's just, unless there was something else, it's just kind of odd to me that they started to focus in on you right away.
No, that was as far as I know, that was it. So before I was a teenager, I wanted to be a cop.
Yeah.
And I grew up. That was a career I wanted to have. And so, you know, that intersected with one of the police tactics. So about 6 weeks, I had a lot of interaction and interviews mm-hmm. with police, and it would always start out, they would start talking to me as if I was a suspect, and then when they would push too hard and I would get afraid, I'd want to get away from them, Jeff is the junior detective helper theme was what they utilized. And you know, and they would say things like, well, the kids won't talk freely around us, but they will around you. Let us know if you hear anything. Stop in from time to time. They would ask me opinion questions and congratulate me that my opinions were correct. And so mm-hmm. wanting to be a cop when I grew up, that being something that I had wanted to do previously.
Yeah, so you were fascinated with it, you know?
Yeah, that was how they wrote, that was kind of how they wrote me in. And
yeah.
And eventually they got me to agree to take a lie detector test. They told me, look, we have some new information that's come in. It's in our file. We want to share that with you. And that'll allow you to be more helpful to us, but you have to pass this polygraph for us. And plus, you know, that portion of the conversation when we talk to you as a suspect, we can put all that, you know, behind. We don't have to do that anymore. So yeah. I felt, well, why not?
Yeah.
So the next day, instead of going to the high school, I went to the police station where I had heard through the rumor mill that other people had been polygraphed there. So my mother and grandmother thought I was in school, so they didn't call around looking for me. They drove me from Peekskill, which is in Westchester County. They drove me to the town of Brewster in Putnam County. So it was about 40 minutes away by car. So that meant I couldn't leave anymore. I was totally dependent upon the police.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was by design, obviously.
Absolutely, sure. So I didn't have any attorney present. I wasn't given anything to eat the entire time I was there. They gave me a 4-page brochure, which explained how the polygraph worked, but it had a lot of big words in it that I didn't understand. But then, mm-hmm. you know, I pushed past my own concern by thinking that, you know, I'm here to help the police. You know, what does it matter? Let's just get on with it.
Yeah.
So from there, they put me in a small room and gave me countless cups of coffee. It seems kind of clear in hindsight, the purpose of the coffee was to get me wired up. Yeah. And then they attached this polygraph machine to me. And then this polygraphist, by the way, was actually a Putnam County Sheriff's investigator, but he was dressed like a civilian. He never identified himself as a police officer. He never read me my rights. And he launched into his third degree tactics. So he invaded my personal space. He raise his voice at me. He kept asking me the same questions over and over again. I mean, as he put it during his trial testimony, he carried out this procedure, which he said called GTC, get the confession.
Yeah.
And he kept that up for 6.5 to 7 hours. And eventually, towards the end, he made the statement. He said, he told me, what do you mean you didn't do it? You just did it through you just told me through the polygraph test that you did. And we just want you to verbally confirm it. And that really shot my fear through the roof. And at that point, the officer had been pretending to be my friend. He came in the room and told me that the other officers were going to harm me, but they'd been holding them off, but he couldn't do so indefinitely, that I had to help myself. Then he added that if I did as they wanted, that they would stop what they were doing and I could go home afterwards, that I wasn't going to be arrested. Being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, I wasn't thinking about the long term. I was only concerned about my safety in the moment. I was overwhelmed emotionally and psychologically. And then there was, you know, the possibility of harm had been thrown in the air, and there was this false life preserver he had threw me. So I made the decision to make up a story based on the information that he had given me that day and in the 6 weeks run up to it. But by the time everything was all said and done, I had collapsed on the floor, crying uncontrollably. I was in a fetal position. Obviously, I was arrested. I was charged with a murder and rape.
And the mind game that they did on you at such a very young age. I mean, you're talking about this, Jeff, and I'm just going, first of all, how can they have you in custody? Because you are in custody. You can't leave. How can they have you in custody and they're asking you accusatory questions? And I know you've probably talked about this a lot. Miranda rights just go out the window? You even said it. I mean, Miranda was never read to you. Usually what happens in my experience is, you know, whenever you have a juvenile and you're, you know, in an interrogation, which is what you were in, even questioning something, where's the parent? You know, did they ask permission?
Right. Okay. So no, they did not ask permission. In fact, they knew that my mother did not want me talking to them. You know, I knew that my mother didn't want me to talk to them either. But, you know, I was 16, and that's a time where
you thought you were trying to help them, too.
And I was trying to help the police. But then on top of that, you know, it was the age where, you know, kids start to try to assert their autonomy and we know better than our parents do. And so there was a little bit of that. But also, like you said, I was trying to help the police, and I didn't understand what her point was. And look, I didn't do anything. They're asking me to help them. What can possibly go wrong? So that's what was going through the mind. In terms of the Miranda rights, so I was given the Miranda rights before I was transported across county lines. And so that was how they got around that. But the issue is that first of all, by my age, 16, I didn't understand my Miranda rights.
So exactly.
To me, I don't know what it means. And secondly, he's adding to the confusion that would be there already just by this whole Jeff is this junior detective helper theme that they had going. So that's as far as that. But the last point I'll make is in New York State, and a lot of states across the country, 16 years old, you're able to waive your rights and speak to the police without parental permission.
Yeah, you can. But again, usually I'm not going to get into the weeds. I mean, it just, you know, they used it against you. They coerced you, obviously, based on what you said. They took part, you know, they took advantage of the emotional state you were in. They took advantage of the state, you know, the fact that you wanted to become a cop. I mean, it's just horrible. So you get convicted. You spend 16.
Yes, but I want to just mention something before I get convicted. Just
okay, go ahead, bro.
Just a little bit. So in terms of interrogation, since we were just talking about that, it was not videotaped. It was not audio taped. There was no signed confession.
Wow.
It was just the officer's word.
Word
and word. So I'm gonna get. I didn't get to put my word in because I wanted to testify, and my lawyer wouldn't allow me to. And so it's just their words, but they left the threat and false promise out of their story.
Yeah, which you know, obviously, and the listeners probably know, you cannot promise things to people. You can't make deals to people. Or suspects. I mean, you can't do that.
Right. I 100% I agree with that. Now,
but you didn't know that at the time, yeah.
I didn't know that at the time, right. But before I went to trial, the results of a DNA test came in because there was seminal fluid, you know, found in and around the victim. And the results didn't match me. But instead of acknowledging they made a mistake, the prosecutor continued full speed ahead. He got the medical examiner to commit fraud. He claimed, after DNA didn't match me, he claimed that he suddenly remembered that he forgot to document medical evidence that he said had showed that Angela was promiscuous. So wow. that allowed the prosecutor to argue that it didn't matter that the semen didn't come from me. That didn't mean I was innocent. There was just yet another person that she slept with before I murdered and raped her. So in order to wrongfully convict me, they were willing to trash her reputation. Wow. And her family was not coming to court, so they had no idea what was being said about her in the courtroom. Then taking it a step further, he mentions another youth by name that he claimed had probably slept with the victim. But again, he didn't set the proper evidentiary foundation. So you would think that they would call him. They would call him as a witness to give testimony to that effect. They would ask him for a DNA sample to try to prove that, but he didn't do any of that. Now, after the DNA didn't match me, the police officers went back in the field and they interviewed 17 witnesses who knew the victim in one capacity or another. And all of them told the police that there was no consensual sex, that she didn't have a boyfriend, but they didn't document any of those witness interviews. Jesus. And as a result of that, there was nothing to turn over.
Wow. I mean, it's just
then the last thing I'll mention is, the police falsely attributed a statement to me. They claimed that I said to them that I didn't know if the perpetrator ejaculated or not. But that statement, first of all, that word wasn't in my vocabulary as a 16-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, that statement does not appear in any of their written reports as to the interrogation and what was said. It doesn't appear in their early reports. It only appears after the DNA didn't match me. So it seems clear that they came up with that in order to help the prosecutor fight the DNA.
It's just...
At the same time, my attorney didn't defend me. He never called as a witness my alibi. I was actually playing wiffle ball when the crime happened. He rarely met with me. And every time I tried to tell him what happened in the interrogation room that I was innocent, he told me that he didn't care if I was guilty or innocent, he said that. And he never explained to the jury the significance of the DNA not matching me. He never used that to argue the confession was coerced or false. And he never attempted to discredit this medical examiner whose fraud was playing such a large role. And at the end of it, I was, in fact, as you said, I was wrongfully convicted and given a 15 to life sentence because I was charged as an adult and I was sent to a men's maximum security prison.
Wow. And just out of curiosity, Jeff, was this a public defender? Was it a private attorney or what?
It was a public defender.
Okay. Now, I know you're sent to prison, 16 horrible years for a crime you didn't commit. You appealed, you continued to appeal your conviction, and it kept on getting slapped down, denied. I think you appealed to more post-conviction DNA testing, but right. The DA's office at that time was headed by Jeanine Pirro, who's a very famous judge now, refused to accept your request. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. So the DNA data bank had been created in 1997, 98. And so previously, the technology that the DNA technology that was used simply allowed items of a crime scene to be compared to a particular suspect. Mm-hmm. And the DNA data bank changed that. It allowed the item to be entered into the data bank to be compared against samples of many other people.
Talk about CODIS, right?
Talking about CODIS, yes.
Yeah,
and in addition to that, part of the reason why I was hopeful as the DNA data bank is because in an unrelated case in Westchester, DA Pirro agreed that another defendant, Terry Chalmers, should be exonerated, who was wrongfully imprisoned for rape, because the DNA didn't match him. And in explaining her decision to the public to agree to exonerate him, she made a lot of pro-DNA type statements. So I wrote her and asked her for permission to test that. Look, there's this old case in your file. And when I got denied there, that request was also put into the federal court, and they wouldn't allow me to get the DNA tested. So ultimately, I lost 7 appeals.
Wow.
And then because when I went to the parole board, I maintained my innocence instead of expressing remorse and taking responsibility. And so I got denied parole there. And, you know, I lost another chance to regain my freedom.
Yeah. But a new DA came in. A new DA mm-hmm. was elected.
Yes.
And then, you know, you gained the support of a very famous and much needed group, the Innocent Project. Can you talk about that?
Yes, of course. Yes, the Innocence Project agreed to represent me. So those were two big factors. And then they took the crime scene DNA evidence and they compared it to the DNA data bank, and it matched the actual perpetrator whose DNA was in the data bank because left free while I was doing time for his crime, and he killed his second victim, a school teacher who had 2 children. And so my charges were dismissed on actual innocence grounds, and he was arrested and charged with a crime.
Jeez. Now, Jeff, was there any, I was doing some research and maybe I just missed it, but I'm going to ask you, was there any repercussions with the police and everybody else that was in this chain, this flawless or this, flawed investigation that you had to endure? Was there any repercussions for the police who covered stuff up, the ME, the district attorney's office? I mean, I know they have some sort, you know, they have a degree of immunity, but was there any kind of repercussions?
No, the short answer is no. I mean, I did file lawsuits against, but that's against the municipalities. Right. The only consequences that they ultimately were was that the medical, when I filed the lawsuit against the Westchester County because of the actions of the medical examiner, he suddenly retired. And the prosecutor suddenly resigned and ran to Florida 2 weeks before I emerged. So that was the only indirect consequences.
Well, I'm sorry. Obviously, me saying sorry doesn't bring back 16 years of your life, but it's horrible that you had to go through that, Jeff. And that's a good segue into, let's talk about your foundation. Let's talk about the documentary. Again, I had Gia Wirtz on the show, did an amazing documentary about your story. Let's talk about your foundation first, Jeff.
Sure. So when I was it took about 5 years for me to get compensated. And once I did, I wanted to try to free people. I'd done a bunch of work as an advocate for my first 5 years, just as an individual advocate. I was speaking, I was doing media interviews, meeting with elected officials. And I was also a columnist for a weekly paper. But when I got compensated, I wanted to try to free people. Mm. And so I took $1.5 million from the money that I got, and I started the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. And we've been able to free 10 people now.
Wow.
That were wrongfully imprisoned. And we changed 3 laws pertaining to videotaping interrogation, better identification procedures, DNA database expansion. Then as a part of the coalition group, which my foundation is part of, and which I'm an advisory board member of, called It Could Happen to You, we were able to pass 3 additional laws pertaining to oversight of prosecutors and discovery reform, which pertains to sharing information between the defense and prosecution. Yeah, so, I mean, those have been our accomplishments. And, while I was doing the advocacy work and afterwards, you know, I did pursue formal education. While I was wrongfully imprisoned, I got the GED and associates, mm-hmm. and I completed a year towards the bachelor's degree. Then the funding was cut for that. But I got a scholarship from Mercy College to finish the bachelor's degree.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I have a master's degree from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice.
With wow.
And on wrongful conviction causes and reform. And I also have a law degree from the Elizabeth Haupt School of Law at Pace University. And earlier this year in October, I was admitted to the bar, so I'm an attorney.
Wow.
I got tired of sitting in the front row of the courtroom. I wanted to sit.
You wanted to be a player.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you get it. Yeah. Yeah. So, I did that. I also just want to give a brief mention. I do serve on the Global Advisory Council for Restorative Justice International, and mm-hmm. I advise them on different wrongful conviction issues. And then, there is an application of restorative justice on wrongful conviction. Restorative justice is a concept that means that you try to restore people back to the position that they used to be in before. So I think society can try to, there's an application of that as far as society and the person who was exonerated in terms of compensation and reentry assistance. And I met up with the, I spent a couple weekends with Angela's family at their request, and we had kind of like an emotional healing type of thing as well, like our interaction. Like, you know, they thought for many years that I was the person who killed Angela, because that's what the police had told them.
I mean, now talk, brother, really quick about, you know, the amazing documentary that Gia and you worked on. It tells about the story. Where can people find it? Where can people watch it?
So it's called Conviction. People can watch it on Amazon Prime. And it's about my advocacy work and my life after exoneration. It's been selected by 11 different film festivals, and it's won 3 awards. Best Cinematography, Best Documentary, and award of distinction. So in that documentary, I mentioned what it's about, but you when you watch it, it's about more than just wrongful conviction. Mm-hmm. You know, in that documentary, I am talking about some of the other important criminal justice issues. So I talk a little bit about, you know, disgusting things I saw in prison that just simply shouldn't be from a moral point of view. I talk about prison reform and, you know, compassionate release for prisoners that are terminally ill. I talk about the elderly in prison, and I talk about parole reform. And so all those other issues that, you know, as a society, you know, we need to do better. I mean, people are supposed to be sent to prison as punishment, with the punishment being loss of freedom, right? We need to make sure we get the guilty people in, not the innocent. But once that's done, you know, the penalty is the loss of freedom, and there's supposed to be rehabilitation taking place at the same time. They're not sent to prison to be punished, to be mistreated. Because if they are, what kind of people do you think that they're going to be when they come back out?
Yeah, and I always tell people, Jeff, and you know this, that the majority of people incarcerated are going to get out at some point. There's a very small percentage of people doing, you know, so many years to life or sitting on death row. The majority of people, as you know, are going to get out. So I agree with you 100%. We need to do a better job at reentry back into society. We need to spend more money, get more resources, because, you know, Jeff, the recidivism rates are through the roof. It's a revolving door. It's a revolving door.
It really is. There's a 68% national recidivism rate. Now, in contrast to that, there's a nonprofit in New York called Hudson Link, which provides college education for prisoners through a nonprofit model. I mean, we definitely need the government to be involved. But in the interim, until that happens, and it looks like it's going to happen soon, there was some legislation passed nationally pertaining to restoration of Pell Grants for prisoners. But their recidivism rate is 2%. So if you spend some money, you save money, and you know people paying into the tax base rather than draining from it. And then look, who do you think is more likely to make a successful return to society, to live a law-abiding life? Somebody that has gotten a college education now to get gainful employment and their horizons are expanded, or somebody that's, you know, just as uneducated as they were going in, maybe more so now because they're behind the times in terms of technology. So I think, and plus, who wants to get a second set of crime victims? And, you know, the rhetoric that has been there against college education for prisoners previously, why should a prisoner get a free education when I can't?
Because they're going to get out.
Right. See, here's the thing: is that the financial aid forms are
exactly
the, nobody would be eligible to go to school on a grant simply because they're in prison. That would not have been able to do it. And then there's just a small percentage. It was like half a percent or 1.5% nationally. The total number of students across the country that went to college through a grant while incarcerated. So it's not like for every person who went to college while incarcerated that there's a corresponding person outside that's been denied a seat because of that.
Yeah, a lot of work that needs to be done, brother. Thank you for your work. Now, you do work a lot with law enforcement too.
Yes, I do. Yeah. So, the fight against wrongful conviction is about accuracy and justice. It's not anti law enforcement. It's not anti cop or it's not anti prosecutor. It is against officers who, you know, engage, break the law and engage sure. in tactics, but it's not against the law-abiding ones, and certainly not as to the prosecutor. So for the last 6 years, I've co-taught the morals and ethics class at a police academy in New Jersey. I'm certified in New Jersey as an instructor there. And what I add to it is this. So first of all, example of one case, right? One instance. So that's my case. I explain all the impact on me. I explain all the different ways the police officers went wrong in my case. And then after that, I do advocate, look, you're the first line of defense in preventing a wrongful conviction. If you don't arrest the wrong person, the train don't pull out the station. Yeah. So that's one. And I encourage them to voluntarily implement best practices, record interrogations, use the best available, you know, lineup procedures, you know, document all your witness interviews. Don't test the lie when you come to court. And I share other techniques. Like, so, wow. For example, if there's an alternative suspect, you should, and you believe the other person committed the crime, not the alternative suspect, you should try to prove how the alternative suspect could not have committed the crime prior to making an arrest. And I share, like, these are the red flags that, you know, a confession might be false, as demonstrated by cases where DNA exonerations have happened, but the conviction of which originated from a confession. And, you know, these are the red flags around identification evidence. And here are a few signs that maybe an informant isn't telling the truth. So I arm the officers with that information. But beyond the officers, I've also done 4 or 5 presentations in front of groups of judges. They've asked me to address different wrongful conviction topics. And sometimes I've spoken in front of groups of prosecutors. So I was invited several times to speak at the Queens District Attorney's Office. So yeah, I do work with law enforcement on that basis.
Well, you know, I mean, I when you were talking, Jeff, and maybe some of the people listening probably are thinking the same thing. If anybody would have a reason to be pissed off and never talk to anybody in the criminal justice system, it would be you. And I think it's very admirable that you are doing your amazing work with your foundation, but you also are trying to educate, and you are educating first responders and people in criminal justice, including judges, of the dangers, obviously, understatement, with wrongful convictions and other criminal justice reform that needs to take place in this country. I think we've come away, but I think we have a long way to go.
Sure. If I just want to add just one final thought.
Go ahead, brother.
Yeah. I just want to mention that, you know, in terms of the whole idea of, you know, defund the police, you know, I've spoken at different rallies. Let me just say this, you know, I'm for police reform. I think it's, I don't agree with defunding the police. You know, when I call 911, I have to call 911. I don't want to be put on hold.
Yeah, exactly.
Answer the phone and send help, like, immediately, if not sooner. And I'd like the officers who respond. I don't want social workers or other mental health experts responding. So I just want to say that in terms of, you know, in defense of the blue, so to speak, with respect to that. Now, I do think there's a lot of room for, you know, I do think officers should be given more training in terms of dealing with people who have psychological crises. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there's way too many incidents of brutality. There's way too much unjustifiable deadly police force. There really shouldn't be any. And I do think that it's a problem that when people are caught on camera and, you know, they committing, again, unjustifiable deadly police force, there's a silence on the part of the police, but when a police officer is killed, then there's a big procession, it's a big thing, and it should be a big thing. It's the most horrendous thing that could possibly happen, but if it's not a problem if a civilian is killed, right, then just this us versus them and bad community relations, it's only going to perpetuate. And so I do call for people on both sides of that, you know, try to come in the middle, and we need to get better training and better attitudes, and we all need to just be united, you know, in terms of the pursuit of justice. And I think that's what's at the core. I would like to believe that nobody ever goes to the police academy because they want to kill someone and get away with brutality, or they want to arrest the wrong person. But somewhere along the line, sometimes, you know, you do the wrong things, or you lose your way, or the negative peer pressure. I want the honest police officer. And I say this at the academy all the time. Yep. Yeah. I want the honest officers, right? Turn on the ones that are breaking the law. They're not part of you. You're law enforcement. But when someone breaks the law, they're on the other side of the street. There's no more unity. Even if you do it the other way and you look the other way, you allow that to become the norm. You allow that to be the peer pressure to take hold.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what ruins everything, in my opinion.
Yeah, and very well said. And I can say, you know, spending over two decades in law enforcement, I think there's a lot of problems in law enforcement, obviously. But I don't think it's like the days of Serpico. You remember Serpico, Jeff. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, most police departments, again, I can't speak for every department out there. Most cops, you know, they hate bad cops more than anything. You know, there are bad cops out there, unfortunately. I think the majority are trying to do a very tough job in a very tough environment. But Jeff, I appreciate you coming on, sir. If anybody wants to find Jeff, they can find him at deskofvicfoundation.org. You got to watch his TED Talk, Jeff. I was telling you, I watched it earlier. Amazing. Amazing. And everything's going to be linked up in the show notes, sir. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for sharing your story. And thank you for your amazing work with criminal justice reform and everything else you're doing, sir.
Wow, I appreciate your words. They really reinforce me. Thank you very much. And thanks for having me on as well.
Jeff, anything we can do for you, brother, you get my contact information, you just reach out, let me know.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.